coming to get you, Barbara.
I don't know what you come to do, but I come to praise name.
Because you'll never be anything but a common frump whose father lived over a grocery store and whose mother took in washing.
Hi, I'm April Wolf, and you're listening to Who Shot Ya? Joining me in the studio today are reviews editor at The Wrap, Alonzo Duralde.
Hello.
Hey, what's good?
Your enthusiasm level is what's great. It is knocking me off my chair. What's good is the Criterion Channel launched, which Woo-hoo. Is super exciting. And there's another thing that out there that people should know about called Ovid. It's OV as in Victor ID .TV, which is another, it's a consortium of all these cool little kind of micro labels. So it's like Bullfrog and Kim Stim and Women Make Movies and Grasshopper and Icarus. So a lot of,
there's
some arty shit in there. Super arty shit. Yeah. Yes. So like tons of documentaries, tons of foreign films, names you'll recognize, like, you know, Claire Denis movies and, you know, Raul Ruiz and people like that. And that 5-hour Japanese movie Happy Hour that I raved about once is my staff pick. That's on there. You can stream it to your heart's content. So yeah, Criterion Channel is awesome, but don't sleep on Ovid.tv if you want to get deep.
But it's not pronounced Ovid?
Isn't it like the Latin
junior high Latin, we pronounced it Ovid.
It's Ovid. Yeah. Really? See, I don't know. I mean, I know how to like say like in nomine Patri, Spiritu Sanctu, Amen. Like
that's those words
who shot who in the what now?
Yeah. Words you always read but never hear. You know, like for years I thought misled was a verb, and then I discovered, oh no, it's misled.
Yes, there are a lot of words that I know how to spell comfortably and like would feel really happy using in a sentence.
Oh my god!
And speaking, just don't I make would you just say be them. Yeah. No,
I think
miserable.
when I was in grade school, I said epitome out loud as I was I had to read things.
Nice. Yeah,
and I was just and then like years later, someone told me that like, when I was in high school, like, oh, that's epitome.
apostrophe.
Right.
This other voice that you are hearing, this lovely lady, is a producer and film festival programmer, Drea Clark. Hi, Drea.
Hi.
What's good?
Hi. You guys, I found the best news this week. And by that, I mean like an article of news. Normally, whenever you see a news story, it's just another garbage nightmare.
Yeah, it's like kittens or a nightmare.
Right. Right. That's basically it.
That's my feed, at least.
So what's good is I found the thing in between those.
Yeah.
My favorite news story of this week is titled, Who is Leaving Bowls of Mashed Potatoes Around Jackson, Mississippi?
Oh!
And you guys...
I was going to guess Florida Man, but...
Right. But it's even... I feel like they would taste better in Jackson, Mississippi. It's so good. There's for real someone who has not been leaving any demands. They've been leaving random bowls of mashed potatoes around... And they, like, reported it on their local TV news as well. They don't know if it was a prank, if it's someone with leftovers. But somebody posted
someone
a picture.
Leftovers.
Like, someone posted a picture on Facebook. And then someone else was like, wait, somebody put a bowl of potatoes on my car, too. Anyway, I think it's so good. They showed up on mailboxes and cars.
I love a small-town police blotter.
Those oh, yeah.
Yes, right? But that's such a good one. I've never been to Jackson, Mississippi. I will be disappointed if I go there and there are not mashed potatoes randomly.
You'll be hiding around the corner of your car waiting.
Yes, I'm like, oh, it's going to come any minute. But this is way better than, remember when those clowns were just popping up all over?
Oh, yeah.
And Jackson's like, clowns? Who needs clowns when
Hold
you can
my
have
gravy.
Some delicious carbohydrates coming your way? So that's what's good with me.
April, what's good with you?
Yeah.
Oh.
Ooh, God, he got right in there. He's so good.
No. Socks. And I'm not talking about the Clinton's dead cat. I'm talking about actual socks. This is this thing that like I don't buy clothes or things for myself that often, and like socks even less. Like lots of holes in there, and I just realized that I was just like, what am I even matching these for? Like they're like falling apart. Like what am I doing? And I just had like a moment of like just clarity where I was like, I just need new socks. What am I doing? And then I like looked and I was thinking like, when was the last time I bought socks? And I was like, 4 years ago? Like
a new pair of socks is just like It's a new lease on life.
I feel like I'm walking on air. Yeah. These are just like Hanes.
It's
like
magical.
This is nothing special.
You are clearly not friends with enough Vietnam veterans, because I feel like one of the number one takeaways that I always heard about was that socks were the most treasured item you could have.
This is like a, I mean, I guess you're hanging out with a lot of Vietnam vets. I'm not sure.
How do you think I'm going to get to those potatoes? Like, I know who's going to get me there.
I should be hanging out with more Vietnam vets. They would have told me that socks are for...
Sometimes it's something you have to find out on your own. And look how good you feel that you did.
And are they wicking socks? Because that's even more special.
Yeah, the ones I'm wearing today, because I go jogging a lot. Mm. Yeah, it's wicking.
Nice.
Wicking. So, today on Who Shot Ya, we're going to be talking about Pet Sematary, the remake.
Yes.
We've also got a call from the Who Shot line, and we've got some staff picks as always. But... we should maybe get into our news segment, which is called It a Dick, short for Is This Important? Do You Care? So, I'll read the first one.
Nailed it.
In a recent profile by GQ, Keanu Reeves revealed that Fox Studios blacklisted him for 10 years for not making Speed 2. After the success of Speed in 1994, Fox wanted to make a sequel. Keanu turned it down to star in a stage production of Hamlet in Winnipeg. According to the profile, Keanu was sent to movie jail and didn't work with Fox again until 2008's The Day the Earth Stood Still. If you remember, Fox ended up replacing Keanu with Jason Patrick for the sequel, Speed 2, Cruise Control. And it was bad.
Yes,
is this important? Do you care?
Well, I have actually been reading last week's
guest. You're gonna stop, full stop.
He's
there.
Like,
I've been reading.
And it's great. No, I've been reading our last week's guest, Brian Raftery's book about 1999.
Oh, yeah. I dug in, too. It's a pretty great book.
And so he talked, there's a whole Matrix chapter, and he talks about how Keanu's career post-Speed was not great because he, you know, made some not great in retrospect choices like Johnny Mnemonic and, you know, Feeling Minnesota or whatever.
A great movie.
So, okay.
Go ahead.
Anyway, so I think even if I don't know that making Speed 2 Cruise Control would have been any better a choice than that. And I think being available to do The Matrix certainly didn't hurt him. So, you know, it all worked out.
Fair.
Yeah. I think, honestly, people, if you haven't read that GQ profile of Keanu, I like all profiles of him because he's such a strange...
And it comes with photos and they look like Keanu Reeves. So that helps, too.
Beautiful.
He's the most beautiful. He's probably my favorite movie star.
No, I think so, too.
Because
yeah, me too.
I love what he does as a movie star in terms of his persona. I love the action stuff. I love that, similar to April Sox, he's John Wick. No? Too far?
Wow.
Too far?
Wow.
Too close, probably. I think he makes interesting choices. It is funny thinking of a time of his career when he was not the one making those choices. But I do like how he approaches things and how he seems to treat people. And
never forget, Roger Ebert gave Speed 2 4 stars.
Oh, my God.
Out of 4.
Yeah, I was going to say, how many?
Roger was having a great day. He, got laid. He was like, yeah.
I don't know what they were serving at that theater, but I would have liked some.
And we should always remember that Bill and Ted 3 is coming out in 2020.
That's right. Yes. And before that, John Wick Chapter 3, Parabellum. I don't even know what that is.
Parabellum.
Parabola, yeah.
No, it's a math term.
Parabola.
Yeah.
It's May 17th.
No, it is parabellum.
It is parabellum. Just, yeah. Yes.
I don't really know math.
I epitomed you.
Again, my what Latin I learned in junior high does not tell me what parabellum means. This past week, the 43-year-old agreement between the Writers Guild of America and the Association of Talent Agents expired. As a result, the WGA has called for all of its members to fire their agents. The reason agreement wasn't reached was largely due to the disagreement between the two sides over the practice of packaging. Packaging is where agents are paid for bundling talent and bringing them as a package to a studio or network for film or TV projects. The ATA asserts this practice actually makes more money for the writers, but the Writers Guild largely contests this claim, citing a conflict of interest for agents that has caused a decline in writer earnings. Is this important? Do you care?
It's everything.
It's so important.
Yeah, it's huge.
Everything. This is so fucked up that I think I would like to call out how the media has been portraying this, because fucking Deadline, Hollywood Reporter, New York Times.
All the time.
all over the place. There are people that they could ask from the WGA, but they're not. I don't know where they're getting their sources from, but this is a really very simple problem. And I was trying to say that on Twitter, and it's been expressed in many a thread that, like, these, like the equity funds, the you know, they're buying out these companies, and then you have to return a much higher profit. So that means that they don't really care about the money that they're getting from their clients. They're just caring about the money that they can get from packaging, and they're trying to squeeze their clients out of this. So it's just the companies being bought by equity fund people.
But even more than that, like just the agreements themselves, that a showrunner could have a show that their agent set up, yeah, fine, and that if the agency gets packaging, that packaging generally, like what you're referring to as well, but it means that the agency will continue to get money, a percentage of every single episode of that show, even if their client is fired, even if that person doesn't do anything else. So they're operating in their own interests.
Like, that's a
well, yeah, and like, how is an agent going to, you know, like go to bat against a studio to get a writer paid what he or she deserves when the agent is also in bed with that studio, right, because of this whole?
Yeah, and that's an interesting thing that Drea brings up, because there was a letter that was published by writer and the Slap creator John Revan Bates.
I love that. That's what we're calling him now.
I mean, he's also the writer of that
terrible
Stonewall movie.
That's true. Yes,
he's
a playwright. Okay,
he's a playwright.
His film and TV credits are a little more embarrassing.
Yeah, but
he did Brothers and Sisters.
I read that play.
He's the SB's and Honey Drowned guy, right? Or is that that's Douglas Carter Beans.
I'm just going to say that, like, having been a playwright myself, the standards for playwriting, not as high as film and TV. Just going to say it.
You really just kind of burned yourself.
Yeah.
Just saying.
I know. But, you know, there are good, great playwrights, and they can do anything. But, like,
I interrupted you because he wrote a letter
and the thing is that he kind of undercut his own point, because he was saying that he was fired from his own show, Brothers and Sisters, mm-hmm, what you were saying earlier. And he was like, oh, and then as soon as I got fired, you know, my agents got me back to work. And but he didn't even talk about the fact that even though he got fired, his agents continued getting at least 3% on every episode.
More than that.
From the budget,
because,
at least.
Yeah, it's not just the 3%. It's they get like up to 10% on... It's a huge amount. They can get millions of dollars on an episode for something. And the fact that he was like so gracious, oh, they got me back to work. Yeah, so they can make more money off of
you. Like, if you're still employable,
dude,
then they're going to make you work.
Standing up against your union is never a good look.
No. Yes, I'm pro-union anyway. And if people are interested in this, and I think you should check out his website anyway, but David Simon has written some very David Simon salty language about what packaging really entails. It's very complicated. I don't fully have all of it, and I've been part of package
That's
deals.
Right. John Robin Bates clearly has idea what he's talking about, and he's really great at saying it.
But I would check out. I would check out the. I would check out David Simon's writing about it, because
it has prompted so much shade on the Slap on Twitter this week, though. So that's been interesting.
Yeah, sure. It's fun. This is fun.
That's the fun fallout.
What else we have?
Oh, yeah. Okay, so I like this one because it's an exciting story for our times, but also because it allows Alonzo Duralde and I are going to put forth a little scene for you, April. So I don't know if you read this, but in a very interesting recent interview for The Verge, Emily Yoshida talked to director Werner Herzog about new movie-making technology, film schools, and his online masterclass series. But the conversation also spent a great deal of time on Werner's interest and confusion with the game Pokemon Go. And here's how it went.
Tell me about Pokemon Go. What is happening on Pokemon Go?
It's basically the first mainstream augmented reality program. It's a game where the entire world is mapped and you walk around with the GPS on your phone. You walk around in the real world and can catch these little monsters and collect them. Everybody's playing it.
Does it tell you you're here at San Vicente, close to Sunset Boulevard?
Yeah, it's basically like a Google map.
But what does Pokemon do at this corner here?
You might be able to catch some. It's all completely virtual. It's very simple, but it's also an overlay of physically based information that now exists on top of the real world.
When two persons in search of a Pokemon clash at the corner of Sunset and San Vicente, is there violence? Is there murder?
They do fight virtually.
Physically, do they fight?
No.
Do they bite each other's hands? Do they punch each other?
The people or the...
Yes, there must be real people if it's a real encounter with someone else.
And scene.
And scene.
Oh, I felt good. Is this important? Do you care?
I feel like I just got put into augmented reality for a second.
I'm working on my impersonation of,
it was so
of
good.
Werner Herzog saying... Jigglypuff.
No, you did an earlier thing where you just...
Do they have a Pikachu?
He knew way more Pokemon than I thought.
Has he talked about this in interviews before?
Pokemon?
Yeah.
No, I feel like it was some random thing that came up.
Should we Google the Herzog Pokemon?
And he just like ran with it.
Because some of the stuff that he's saying, I'm just like... Haven't we heard this before? Like, is there violence? Like he's being such a caricature of himself that you're like, what the fuck?
Is there violence? Is there murder? Is definitely...
This is sort of peak Herzog, really, that he's talking about this in the first place.
The irony of this interview and, like, the crux of what she's getting at, too, is this funny intersection of San Vicente and Sunset, and also that he's talking about because of rises in technology that like film schools are sort of should be obsolete and you just don't need to require them because you can shoot things with your phone, everyone can edit. But then when you talk about other forms of technology, he's like, what? No, I want medieval. I want bloodshed.
Do they have maces?
Do they have maces? Also, I will just say, as someone who taught at USC for 13 years, don't go to film school. I mean, I was an incredible instructor, and there's a lot of people who care that are teaching those things, and you can learn something. But being in film, like, go to, if you have the means to get to college, great. Go get a general, study arts, study film criticism and film theory.
If you want to be a filmmaker, study anything but film in your undergrad.
Actually, playwriting. Playwriting was great for me.
Sure. Yeah. Playwright, psychology, political science, like whatever you want to make movies about, mm-hmm. or just how the world works or how people work, like learn other stuff. The camera angles you can figure out later.
Yeah.
But like learn how learn the soul.
Oh, yes, learn the soul.
Aww.
But also, play as much as you can. Make things on your phone all the time. Like,
yeah.
We're always like, oh, you can make a whole movie on your phone, but are you fucking doing it? Do it. Just do it. Nike swoosh.
Oh, Dre is going to shame you if you don't. So, that was our It a Dick segment. And we're going to take a break. We'll be right back after you hear a word from one of our other Maximum Fun shows.
Hi, it's Ali Kokesh, one of the cast members of Mission to Zinx, a new addition to the Max Fun Network. We're blown away by the welcome we've received from Max Fun listeners, telling us you've discovered the show and are binging it hard, supporting us during the drive, and just being rad humans all around. Mission to Zix is an improvised, obsessively sound-designed sci-fi comedy epic
following a group of ambassadors as they explore the ass end of space. I play Dar, the 12-foot-tall omnisexual security officer with furry scales, chest talons, and a series of flaps and chutes that are for... Yeah, you know what? You'll figure it out. We'd be delighted if you joined our crew aboard the aging sentient starship, the Bargerian Jade, as we travel the Zix Quadrant, meeting all sorts of weird aliens played by brilliant guest comedians. That's Mission to Zix, ZYXX.
Welcome back to Who Shot Ya? I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by...
Drea Clark.
Alonzo Duralde.
Ah, there
she
you
pointed
go.
So fast.
So fast.
I almost wasn't ready.
Yeah, I know. Trying to catch you off guard. Okay, so the movie that we're talking about today is called Pet Sematary. 2019 Pet Sematary.
Yes.
Yeah.
We should be very clear.
Pet Sematary Full Throttle.
Yeah. And I'm gonna look at the script and see who is gonna do the synopsis of this. Oh, it's Alonzo. Would you mind doing the synopsis?
Get into that synopsis, guy.
Sure. Okay. So, It's the second adaptation of the novel by Stephen King with the misspelled title. And Jason Clark and Amy Simetz are a married couple who moved to Maine, because it's always fucking Maine, from Boston. He has had a stressful gig at an ER, but now they want to take it easy and chillax in the countryside. Of course, the house they picked is between a freeway of death and a swamp of not death. So it's
perfect place for trauma survivors.
Yeah, they are. PTSD is gonna just be a faint memory now. So there is a pet cemetery behind the house, and apparently behind the pet cemetery there's this old, spooky ground where you bury things there and they come back. But, you know, sometimes dead is better. And, wackiness ensues.
Wackiness.
Yeah, I'd call it wacky. That's a good, hijinks a good synopsis galore. There. So what do you guys think?
We're diving right in.
I mean, well, first off, like, this is not the original, but how different is it from the original?
I will say, on my perspective, because I'm guessing it's much different, I remember almost nothing about the original. I watched it very young. I mean, so young, because obviously you guys know how young I am. But so I watched it as a kid or whatever, and haven't seen it since. And all I remembered about it was Zelda and the terrifying feeling of that character. And so when I was rewatching, I honestly was like, how do they bring that in? And then when they're introduced, I'm like, oh, it's sort of two stories. So I was watching this with almost fresh eyes. And it had that kind of bumpy quality that a lot of Stephen King adaptations have, where I'm like, oh, I know there's so much stuff that you're getting at here, but each moment isn't necessarily as scary as I'd want it or as thoughtful. But I really like the casting. I will say, I'm a big Jason Clark fan.
Oh, fucking Jason Clark is so great. And I'm obviously a big fan of Amy
Simetz. Like, he was in Winchester, which was like one of my worst worst favorites.
Loved it.
No, you did not.
Winchester?
I loved Winchester.
There's no way.
It is so bad.
Okay, let's. Thank you for that.
That is, like the hush that came over the studio.
Buried that lead, and it came back to life, just terrifying.
He's also in All I See Is You, which is a wonderful little character thriller.
Lawless, and he's in great stuff. Anyway, and I love Amy Simetz, who's been in a ton of interesting indies and has her own show. Anyway, so the casting of it I liked, and I was there for and I also thought John Lithgow did an incredible job. Like, he's so likable, and honestly, one of the best moments of directing where I was like, oh, whoever the director is has a handle on this scene. When John Lithgow's character is introduced, he's introduced because the little girl in the family is wandering around said pet cemetery, and he turns the corner and scary, and then he proceeds to hang out with a unknown young child, which to me is like the red flag in life and in movies, and it manages to be not creepy at all. Like, you're never, anyway, I was like, oh, that actually takes some handling to convey that. Is that specific enough to enjoy?
They make him Pepperidge Farm and not like creepy lurking old guy. I have actually never seen the Mary Lambert version. So
oh, really?
I went in completely.
Oh, I assumed you'd be like,
no,
okay,
I've never. Cool. I'm not a horror guy. You know, like, and I was going to try and catch up with it in time for this, but I
should have tricked you and told you it was a Christmas movie. No way. For real. It's a Christmas movie.
I represent that comment. Anyway, I was kind of bored by this one. I didn't find it super scary. What bugged me was it didn't feel like they had a handle on the characters as much as the concept.
Yeah.
So it's all about the concept of the place where you bury the dead people and they come back, and which is an interesting concept, and they run with it as much as they can. But since I didn't really get a real feel of who these people were and stuff, it didn't land for me. And as much as I love Amy Simetz, and I think she's giving this movie all she's got, I found her backstory kind of goofy. Like,
sure.
I found myself giggling at any showing of a dumbwaiter in this movie. The dumbwaiter is supposed to be super scary, and I was literally just like, I was biting my sleeve not to laugh out loud.
Was there a dumbwaiter in the original?
No.
Because
not that I can remember.
The dumbwaiter was so specific, and also when she returns to the house and there's still a dumbwaiter, I'm like, You think that wouldn't have been ripped out?
Exactly. Like, nobody sealed that thing.
What did you think, Miss Quiet in the corner?
I'm a big fan of the original, and some people can fight me on that, but I'm a big fan of daytime horror, and it is one of those movies where a lot of things do happen in kind of like afternoon shade, and there's like brighter colors.
I was thinking of daytime horror being like daytime drama.
In a sense. but it's a different kind of thing. Sometimes I feel like horror movies right now, they're indicating too much. And in the same way that like an actor might indicate too much of like what they're feeling, then the filmmakers are indicating too much, where it's just like, yes, everything is gray and all these things. But I don't think that that's the only way to get scares. I think that sometimes finding the unexpected route is really interesting. And so I felt a little bit disappointed in some sense that this was such a dark film, literally dark, as opposed to kind of playing with what color palette they were going to have, you know. Kind of felt like the same color palette that I see for a lot of horror films these days.
That's a really good point.
And that to me is a little bit disappointing. I did feel that the backstory for the mother's character was disjointed, and it did come off as silly to me. It's a tough thing when you've got these great actors doing this stuff, though.
That's like, I wanted to give them credit. Like,
She's committed.
The little
for
girl
sure.
too.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Totally. Yeah,
it's
yeah.
So weird. Like every
Jatay Lawrence.
Every actor in this
Jatay,
is just
you
like
stay.
It's great. It's just the something you know like. I don't know if it was like the editing or something else, but like it didn't necessarily feel like it had a sense of fun to it
in a
way that the original had to me. And again, you know, I don't want to compare it too much to the original, but the thing is, I don't think that the story is different enough to not compare it. You know, like there's... Why do we do remakes? What do you guys feel about this? Like, especially in genre films, like we're doing remakes a lot.
Well, I honestly think the number one reason you do them is because the exact case of this room, there's two audience members who presumably could have been privy to the first one, who this was actually brand new to us, let alone a whole new audience. Mm-hmm. So the amount of people who are reticent to watch older films in older films starts at like 5 years ago at this point because you have so many options. So it's, I mean,
but we're
like,
familiar with the property.
Yeah.
Know?
So this has, there's title recognition. There's or name recognition to it, both with Stephen King and with Pet Sematary. And then you either have the people like me who were like, oh, I remember being scared or enjoying that, or I like Stephen King or whatever, or people who were never heard of it, never like there's. So it's a mercenary enterprise.
Well, always. And it's not like you're remaking The Shining or we did get a Carrie remake. But I mean, like this is one of those ones where they're like it is remembered fondly, but nobody tops their list of like best Stephen King movies or best horror movies of the 80s or whatever with Pet Sematary. So it's not like it's so sacred that how dare you try and go back to it. It's like, yeah, okay, we could go back to this well
it's
and maybe
also a great,
find something else to do with it, you know.
It's such an easy, tight premise, right? Like a family discovers that there's a burial ground where people or pets can be brought back to life and make choices with it. Like there's a lot of potential there, but I'm with April. I don't think it was fully explored. I did like it got a lot more interesting to me. It felt disjointed in several ways, but one of those is there's a huge turn. I mean, just in the spoiler sense of the, one of the children might encounter one of the death vehicles that Alonzo mentioned and then subsequently get buried in the pet cemetery and brought back to life. And when the kid comes back, that I was like, oh, this is interesting because there's the possibility for there's weirdly sprinkled through a few religious and sort of faith-based conversations earlier in it, like because they're talking about like what happens when you die. And the mother says, oh, people go to heaven. And the dad, who's a doctor and a scientist, is like, let's not fill her head with that nonsense. And so they've set the tone as if there's going to be an interesting exploration of that.
I wasn't even sure what the movie was eventually saying. It ultimately felt like, wait, so when we die, we go someplace unimaginably awful, and then it's even worse if we come back? Because that's the impression. Like, all the messages she's relaying
so
are
right.
Like, oh, yeah, she's suffering horribly. I'm like, Oh, great. Okay, well, we have that to look forward to then.
All of the takeaways are like, don't die, because all of your options get worse from here.
Yeah. I think, I mean, you guys are kind of hitting on something that, for me, for when it comes to horror, is not having a handle on what your subtext is and on what your metaphors are and what your meaning is. Like, that's kind of a downer for me, because I feel like that should be the first thing that you're thinking about, because that's the vehicle for horror. That's the reason that genre was created, to kind of like titillate as it explores these deeper topics. And so if that's not kind of tightly grasped, and you don't feel like the filmmakers know what they're getting at, then I'm just not sure what works. Because it could be like surrealist, it could be like, you know, whatever it wants to be, all these movies, but there should be some kind of like maybe underlying thing if they're if that's what they set out for.
You're making science fiction, you are commenting on something that's happening in the world right now through the lens of something fantastical. And horror, you are like addressing some facet of the human condition.
Yeah.
You know, and exploring it in a way that doesn't seem like that's what you're even doing.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that I did want to get to when it comes around to like making a remake, especially of a horror movie or sci-fi property, anything genre, is that if you're remaking it today. Why today? Why is it this story today? And I just want filmmakers to be asking themselves of just like, what is particularly on people's minds today that you can explore in this that warrants a remake right now? You know,
like the 70s invasion of the body snatchers is as much about like the me generation as the 50s one is about like, you know, the Red
Scare.
Absolutely.
Yeah. That's, I mean, like that's kind of the pinnacle for the remakes, honestly, is just like, how can you remake something for the decade that you're in?
I thought the Dawn of the Dead remake
did
that as
you
well.
You got it. Yes. You're right.
I love
both
of those, and they spoke to very specific points of American history.
Ricky's not here when we're saying nice things about a Zack Snyder movie, but yes, it's true.
We'll have to like telegraph it to him.
There is something else with the, and that fits in, it's more specific, but the use of the kid that comes back, one of the reasons I was intrigued in that is because we've seen kids in horror is like an ongoing thing, right? It's sure. You see it so many times, and there's generally they're creepy. Even if they're alive, they're creepy. Children, I guess, in horror films, that's what they do. And this one, I actually found there was the possibility that the revived dead kid, the zombie kid, I guess.
Yeah.
It's basically,
zombie,
right?
Undead zombie. Kid, whatever.
Zombie, okay. That the revived dead kid had a really interesting person. Like, there was a menace to what they were doing. I'm trying to avoid which kid it is, but there was a menace to what they were doing, and there was such a quick tonal shift, but it's funny because I really liked what they were doing with the kid, but it also, again, conflicted with the overall idea of theme, because the father, you're supposed to think, is just fueled by grief. Like, what this is, right, is this treatise on grief.
Mm-hmm.
How are we going to respond to
it? Or what it should be.
Yes. And exactly. What it should be. What it wanted to be. And so we see him, and he's grieving. He's done this incredible thing, this horrible thing. The kid does come back, runs into his arms. He's so happy. And literally seconds later, there's this great shot, and he's laying in bed next to the revived dead child, and he's terrified. And it is minutes.
That's a great shot, though.
It's such a good shot.
That's what I wanted.
It's tricky that I was like, I love this moment, but you didn't get me from there to here in a believable way. Because that was such a good moment, right?
It's tough. You know, it's like the pacing of something like this is kind of a magic art, you know? Mm-hmm. Because you're playing with tension, you're playing with stuff. I admire editors of genre movies, specifically horror. I admire the editors. I don't know who edited this. I'm sure that they probably worked very, very hard. Maybe it didn't completely come together, you know, like the pacing, but
a woman named Sarah Brochar, who also edited The Post and Ready Player One.
Oh,
nice.
Shit.
Yeah. Damn.
Okay, so, I mean, I've seen The Post. That's got some really good pacing, and that I just feel like this is, like, it's there, it's just not quite there. And you're dealing with a lot of, you know, you guys saw the trailer, maybe. I was forced to see it in the theater because they just keep showing the fucking trailer. And there's a lot of shots that were cut out that were in the trailer in the same way that us too.
What was in the? Do you remember any?
Yeah, I don't want to say it because.
Okay.
So there's a lot of shots, and you're just like, oh, okay. There's a lot of shot selection, and the edit is like, it's a studio movie. These two directors, this is their first one that I think is a studio film.
It's a duo, right?
Yeah. Are you familiar with their earlier work?
Starry Eyes, and they did one or two more.
Starry Eyes. They did something called Holidays. Absence.
I've seen Starry Eyes. I haven't seen the other ones.
Okay. Identical Dead Sisters.
Uh-huh. I've seen Starry Eyes.
But you're saying Identical Dead Sisters brings me to one of the points that Casey put on this, where it was just like that they quoted that their movie was elevated horror.
Ew, did they really?
Yeah.
Oh, y'all.
In interviews, they called it elevated. And I don't know if it was the studio who was telling them to say that, but it was like... Another instance of, like, not everything has to be elevated horror. We don't know what elevated horror is. I think you know what you're trying to say with that, where it's just like, oh, it's just better than other horror. But it's like, what? You know, like, we've talked about this so many times.
Yeah.
Like, this movie had the opportunity to have more fun to it, is the thing.
Well, both more fun and, yeah, it was just under, what's the golf term, under par? Like,
yes.
If you're, yeah. I'm just like, you got sports. Am I right, you guys?
It's a birdie or a bogey. I don't know.
Yeah. So they hit a birdie with this one. I'm just kidding. I don't know what that means.
Yeah, I don't either.
It was like they were just under par in several, like, thematically, tension, scares. Because there's some, it's almost like they looked at things in chunks, right? Like, this is this block. And then they tackled it, but it didn't necessarily was cohesive with the next one.
Yeah.
Like, I thought there's another nice sequence in terms of actual horror tension when John Lithgow goes back to his house and he's looking for the undead child and who has a scalpel, and you keep getting these set up, and it's this, and there's a few moments I actually was like, what? Like, which I like to yell at the screen.
Yeah, I like a good misdirect.
Yes.
The thing is that, like, here's the hard part, though, because some of the most successful scenes in the movie are the ones that are playing on the expectations of people who enjoyed the original. So,
was that in the original?
So the original, I don't want to give it away, but there is an iconic horror scare that is like one of the best in horror cinema, I think, that comes when you know, the Fred Gwynn character, who's now John Lithgow, is actually searching for this dead child, and there's an iconic scare that comes out there, and so they're playing with the expectations that you think that that's happening, and so they're actually really good at that misdirection and that kind of thing. But so even if you didn't see the original, like, you're still like, oh wow, this is great tension. But the thing is that care isn't applied to the other parts of the film.
Right.
It's the same thing when the dead child, or like when the child gets hit. There's a misdirection because they're playing with the expectations of the original. So,
I didn't know that.
I knew that this movie intentionally switched a bunch of stuff around so that people would feel like it was,
but I mean,
going its own way.
I don't know what it switched around, so I'm going to ask you about it later.
Yeah, it's the stuff that I wish that, like, they had continued doing, you know, just like reimagine that this was that maybe this movie was made 100 times, and what could you do in every scene as like a misdirect? What could you, you know, make?
Sure.
And what do you guys think about the cat?
Cats are the fucking worst, and this movie confirmed to me that cats are the fucking worst.
Now you leave, sir.
I love that cat so much.
The cat was so gorgeous. I looked up all four cats and read several articles about the cats.
Yeah.
The cat grooming was great, whoever was gunking up their hair.
But I will say, April can be with me here on the daughter starts brushing the, like, mottled cat, and I was like, nah, it would never happen. Like, you would never brush a cat like that.
Nope.
And also, I was like, even an undead cat would never let themselves be that dirty. Like, they won't. That actually, unrelated to the cat, but the hair brushing scene in the tub, I was like, none of the people in charge of the scene has ever brushed long, wet hair before.
Well, nobody in this movie seems to know how to brush hair. She doesn't know how to brush a cat's hair.
No one knows how to brush hair.
Like, come on.
I have two different gripes about hair brushing.
Get a wide-tooth comb. Jesus Christ.
Yeah. The cats did a great job, though.
Anyway, what do you guys think? Screen it, stream it, or skip it?
Skip. I think one of the reasons I didn't see the original was after seeing this one, I wasn't particularly, like, gung-ho
I'm gonna
about
make you
it.
See the original.
No, I'm sure it's better.
I'm gonna make you see it in the theater.
I can't imagine that it isn't better, but
that's just different, you know.
Nothing about this movie made me like, oh, I want to see more exploration of this fascinating story, because I was bored. It was 100 minutes and felt like twice as long.
It wasn't Winchester boring to me. Speaking
well, how
of
long
Winchester.
Was Winchester like? Winchester is
like, Winchester is like 80 minutes long.
I was going to say it's like 78.
And it
they
feels
they were
like
that's
172.
All we've got.
It's the worst. I'm super glad we worked in some bags on Winchester. I don't know. This one might be a stream it for me if you're. If you're, it's hard when we do these because if you're like someone who's pulled this Pet Sematary, I think for like the people I was with, it was the second time they'd seen this one. Like,
really?
Yeah. So I think there's enjoyable things about it. When you do see it, please look out that when he is Googling the real Pet Sematary, he spells cemetery wrong again, but in a different way.
I noticed
Thank
that.
You, Alonzo. He spells C-E-M-A-T-E-R-Y. And I was like, there are no A's in cemetery, my dude. Oy vey. But yeah, I guess.
I like that as a little visual gag, though.
Yeah.
Because, like, no one knows how to spell fucking cemetery.
Did you catch the It reference?
No.
When Amy Simons is stuck in traffic on the highway, the sign says Dairy 20 miles.
Oh, no, I didn't see that.
I didn't get that was an It. I thought of Dairy Girls, one of my favorite TV shows.
I thought of Dairy Girls as well. No. I didn't think of It.
Whoops.
So what would you say?
I'm going to go with Stream It.
So for me, I feel, okay, so like, I said stream it for us, but if I were putting this next to us, I would be like, no, definitely screen it. Go to the theater. Even though I'm going to give both of them a stream it, I don't, you know, it's
Wait,
weird.
You're saying this one's better than us?
No.
Backwards.
No. I would say, like, it's one of those things where even though I gave us a stream at the time, if I put those together, I keep thinking about, like, I would still choose seeing us in the theater over
yes.
this,
right.
even though
yes.
I'm giving both of them a stream it.
Right.
Okay.
So just
enough.
Like a caveat to people that
Agreed.
Like not all stream its are equal.
Exactly.
Yes.
Okay.
Agreed.
It's a different kind of stream it.
Here, here.
Don't at us.
Okay. So I guess we made our decisions and we're going to live or die by
we're
them
sticking
now.
With them.
We're sticking with it. We're going to take another break. We'll be right back after we hear from another Max Fun show.
I'm Bailiff Jesse Thorne, and justice is within your reach.
My mom refuses to take my phone calls.
My boyfriend says I should take our cats with me to graduate school, but I think he should keep them.
In the court of Judge John Hodgman, justice rules.
My partner's board game collection is out of control.
My sister won't stop stealing my clothes.
I'm Judge John Hodgman. I'm tough, but fair.
Fair.
I'll bring you justice, and I'm only a click away.
Tipping, automotive etiquette, siblings, roommates. If you've got a case, go to MaximumFun.org/JJHO. Judge John Hodgman is tough, but fair.
Tough, but fair.
Subscribe to the podcast today.
Judge John Hodgman rules.
That is all.
Welcome back to Who Shot Ya? I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined in the studio today by...
Alonzo Duralde.
Drea Clark.
Oh, you slowed down
oh,
my
yeah,
pace.
You
slowed it down.
You guys will meet me.
I'm just looking at this timer. I'm just like, let's go, oh, go, 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 go.
Okay, go.
Okay, so now we have a really fun question from the Who Shot line, and this is from caller Harrison from San Jose. I wonder if he's or they are a Sharks fan.
That was definitely the first thing in my mind.
San Jose
sure.
Sharks has like the best logo in all of hockey.
Oh, my
it's
mind goes.
It's a shark eating a hockey stick. What is it doing there?
My mind goes right to Burt Bacharach, so you know.
Oh, okay, whatever.
Hi, this is Harrison from San Jose, and I watched a particular Stephen King movie over the weekend, and it got me thinking about movies that have dark but happy endings, in my opinion. So I was wondering, for the whole crew, what is your favorite happy ending that is also dark? Hope to hear from you. Thanks.
This is a toughie.
Definitely funny games.
It's right there in the title.
Hilarious.
That's a joke.
The first thing I thought of was The Graduate, which is actually the opposite. It's an ending that seems like a happy ending, but
isn't.
Yeah,
it's actually fucking dark, yeah.
That's a good, yeah. I'm super excited to counter you saying The Graduate. I'll bring up Furious 7, you guys. Paul Walker's last film with the Fast and Furious franchise.
Oh, that was really sad.
But it's set up as a happy ending because you see Paul Walker go to his character go hang out with his family at the beach, and he's getting out of the game so he can be a dad. And then there's like a whole montage narrated by Vin Diesel. And then, you guys, he has one last drag race with Vin Diesel and like this beautiful song where I wept to it, but they give this character that, you know, the actor has had this tragic real life story, and the character gets to go and live on, which I thought was kind of the some would say the epitome of a sad but happy ending.
Except that it kind of screws over Jordana Brewster from being in future installments.
She's still in them. All She's right. like on the phone and shit. Oh, yeah. They'll keep, like, they're family, man. They're family.
It's family. I was thinking a lot about movies where for the good guys to win, they also have to die.
Sure. Yep, yep.
Like The Thing.
Yes.
You know, there's like a bunch of them where like sacrifice is intended.
You know what my favorite
included.
Of those is? Because it's the biggest to me. Cabin in the Woods. Cabin in the Woods, these are all spoilers, but Cabin in the Woods ends with the main characters making, like, full agency, making a decision that rather than, like, kill one of them or they're just going to sit back and let these, like, underground gods take over and destroy humanity. So it's, like, super dark, but they're like, we did it our way.
I was thinking about Dr. Strangelove, which is only a happy ending in a Malthusian sense, but, you know, just this...
Okay.
This idea.
I'm pretty sure that's what the T-shirt says.
The idea is like, well, fuck it. You know what? If we're going to be this stupid, then we all deserve to be obliterated.
I think play
that song again.
For me, Snowpiercer is probably
top
of that list because that ending kind of kills me every time, and it is like. It is bleak, but happy, and then bleaker when you think about it, happy,
great.
And then
you're not really sure
what's okay.
It's like the Broadway musical Urinetown, where like you know they overthrow the evil mayor and they get to flush the toilets again, and then you find out in a postscript that they ran out of water in 2 months and everyone died.
Oh my god. Postscripts will kill you.
The Dead Zone is another one where...
Oh, I love The Dead Zone.
Where the sacrifice is required to bring us to a good place.
I do love... Oh, no. There's so many instances.
Melancholia.
Oh, yeah. The whole world.
I love Melancholia so much.
Is beautiful.
I do love that one.
The end of it is so sad, but so kind of hopeful in a way.
Why is that the one Lars von Trier movie of recent vintage that doesn't bug the shit out of me?
I think it's the one that he made when he was happiest, he said.
Oh, okay.
Ooh.
It was just like he was really happy. And I feel like you can feel that sense of like, it's okay. Everything is fine, you know?
You know what I would put in that, in the sad happy is Logan. I found the ending of Logan because, again, there's something about the idea of characters at the end having full agency in their decisions, and there's a sacrifice to it.
Yeah, sure.
But not just the sacrifice to end that moment, but he is at the end of his run. Like, he starts that film.
The end of
Logan's
run.
Oh, my God. I opened that door wide open. If you hadn't come through it, I would have been standing here with crudité. But, yeah, he begins the film like, already over it and failing and literally like falling apart physically.
Right.
So you know his end is coming, and then that it leads to these mutants and like this life going on and the possibility of it. But you're still like, I was so crying. And when the cross tips over and turns into an X,
right.
You guys, it was so good.
Yeah.
I just thought of one. The Searchers.
Ooh.
Like, you know, she is returned to her family, but he is... exiled from civilization.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Also, the theme of a film called Savannah Smiles that I was in love with when I was young and have never found again. And your laughter tells me you've probably heard of it.
Of course. There's a Girl Scout cookie called Savannah Smiles now.
That's why it's called that?
It would have to be.
I honestly thought I dreamed up
that
movie.
What else could it be named? Oh, there's a whole episode of, like, Pushing Daisies or something that's a riff on Savannah Smiles. It's in the culture.
Oh my God, I really am like, oh, it's this one movie that was made for me and I was the sole audience.
No.
Okay.
You're it. Oh, I guess we could put, like, Skeleton Key might fit in this. Cause, like,
you love Skeleton Key.
Skeleton Key fits in everything.
Thank you. Yeah, because you're like, oh no, they died. And then you're like, oh no, the black people lived.
That's fair.
Like, yeah, they're fine, you know?
Fight Club.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's like had like his personal like journey met, right. falls in love, while of course the city is being destroyed by a terrorist organization
that he started.
That he started. So also, a little happy sad.
Gone Girl.
Oh, yeah, that's
when
a
you're just like, oh, cool, your relationship is going to keep working out.
Or Basic Instinct, for that matter.
Yeah. Rosemary's Baby.
Oh, my God, that
okay,
smile.
Okay, is there anything happy about the ending of Rosemary's Baby?
Yeah, she gets her fucking kid. She gets to raise her child.
It okay, ends with fine. A smile, right? Like, that's the last
that's,
thing of it?
That's true.
Yeah. All right.
And he does have his father's eyes. quoting the film.
They have hooves. It's so funny. Like when I watched that movie again, I was just like, oh, it's so weird. I remember her stabbing the child. She didn't. She didn't stab the child. I had made this up in my head that she stabbed the child in the end of the fucking movie.
Have you not seen the terrible made-for-TV sequel?
No.
Look What's Happened to Rosemary's Baby.
Oh, my God.
It's terrible.
Does she stab the baby?
Baby
he's
stabs
like,
back.
He's like 10 now. It's like
baby stabs it, back.
It's The Omen, basically.
All right. Anyway.
Thank you, Harrison.
Thank you, Harrison. Thank
that
you.
Was good.
And thank you to everyone who has called in so far. There are still some that we haven't gotten through to, but we will definitely play them on the show eventually.
Yes.
Please keep calling, though, with questions. And definitely keep them under a minute. The shorter, the better. Because we need to fit them into the show. We want to actually play them, practice them beforehand.
Yeah, be like Harrison.
Yeah, be quick like Harrison. Harrison. Wow, got in and out. He's got those hockey moves.
Oh
He's
my
in
God.
There.
This poor man.
Harrison's like, I hate hockey. Okay, so the Who Shot line, if you want to call it, it's WSY-803-1664. Again, that's WSY-803-1664. Okay, so moving on, we've got the last segment of our show, which is called Staff Picks and Goodbyes, according to my script. As though I've never been on the show before.
Staff picks and goodbyes.
Well, how does Ricky do this?
you ask us what our
Wait,
staff
what?
Picks
really?
Are.
Really? Oh,
yes.
Okay. All right. So if I just maybe ask Alonzo, what's your staff pick? What would you say?
My staff pick is a film called Wild Nights with Emily. Which
I knew he was going to pick it already, so I didn't say it.
But okay. I wasn't Second sure one. If this was going to be yours or not, but I no. Okay, good deal. All right, so I've been a fan of Madeline Olnick for years. She has directed a couple of comedies that were big hits on the queer film festival circuit, Codependent Lesbian Space Alien Seek Same and The Foxy Merkins, both of which live up to their titles. And this is probably her most mainstream film, but it's really smart and funny, and I think doing a real service to history because it's basically sort of rescuing Emily Dickinson from centuries of biographers who have painted her as this recluse and this, you know, antisocial weirdo who's just holed up in a room
Sad
all the time.
Lesbo. Oh no.
Yeah, I know. Boo hoo. Well, apparently, if you and I love a movie where the press kit has like annotations and footnotes and documentation. And this one does. She was a wild one, that Emily, and she had a lifelong romance with the woman who happened to be her brother's wife, and some other affairs thrown in there as well. And wanted to get her stuff published while she was alive, but only succeeded a few times. And the reason that her initial biographer painted her in such a way was because she had an agenda of her own as the brother's mistress.
Played by Amy
Simons. Played by Amy Simons.
Nice!
Played by Amy Simons in a role that's completely different from the one in Pet Sematary, but she's great in this as well. Emily Dickinson is played by Molly Shannon, who is extraordinary. And if you haven't, I think I already did Other People as a staff pick at some point. Mm-hmm. So great in that and so great in this. And just finding the little notes to play, and this movie is hilarious, but never in a wackety wah punchline kind of way. It's very dry, mm-hmm. very smart. It also integrates the Dickinson poetry into the film in a really smart way. There's a lot of the text that appears on the screen.
It's so good. It's so good.
It's an amazing movie. Go read April's review on The Wrap. Go see Wild Nights with Emily. I'm a big fan.
You just sold me because everything you said is stuff I want to see.
Yeah, it's wonderful. You're going to love it. Drea, if I asked you what your staff pick is, would you have an answer?
I would. Have you guys heard of a film called Savannah Smiles? No, I'm just kidding. Actually, I'm not kidding. Please go see it. Tell me it's real.
It is real. I promise you.
It's my Sinbad's Shazam, or whichever that was. No, my film choice this week is called Hail Satan.
Oh,
and it is
Penny Lane
directed it. It's hard to not sing her name. She's wonderful. She had a previous documentary called Nuts and R. Nixon that I really like. Hail Satan premiered at Sundance this year and is a shockingly funny and charming documentary, because you would think with the subject matter, which is she's following the satanic the evolution of the American Satanic Church, which has actually been put up, and the people behind it have done it in a way that's kind of taking all of the momentum that can be found with social media and just the media in general, and using Satan as kind of a pivot point to draw attention to the hypocrisy of religion that's interfering with our government. And it's amazing. They are like campaigning because like the Ten Commandments like put up, and they're like, oh, well, if that's represented at the courthouse, we also would like a statue of Satan. And so they do a whole thing, and it's great because the people who are involved with it they're basically all like tongue-in-cheek agnostics, mm-hmm. who are using the language of religion to point out a lot of hypocrisies and corruption. It's
worth noting that the title Hail Satan has a question mark.
It has a question mark. That's a good
Hail Satan?
Yeah. But it's really fun and thought-provoking, and you'll see it and chatter like a maniac. And so I would check that out. Hail Satan.
Dre, guess what's streaming right now on Amazon Prime?
No, it's not.
Savannah fucking Smiles.
No, it's not. Yes, 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 yes.
You guys wrap it up. I got somewhere to be.
Okay, quick. Then my staff pick is Smithereens.
You don't have to be quick. It'll still be on Prime when I get home.
Okay. Susan Seidelman's debut feature before she did Desperately Seeking Susan.
Yep.
And she is wonderful. And this is one of those features where you're just like, holy shit, this is your first movie? It is so assured. The camera work is so interesting. The acting is really fascinating. The part of New York that she catches is just, it's everything. You know, we're talking about like films of their time, like this is of its time. It is so on the pulse of everything that was happening in like the 1980s in New York in that time, and specifically with this one woman who's just like not on a good path, but you don't quite see it yet. You know, she's kind of a maverick and she's making her way and she's like really good at this stuff, but then like these cracks open up in her psyche and you're like, this is maybe is not good for her. And you know, you can, yeah, I just love Smithereens.
I like
and
your description.
Yeah, she's Susan Seidelman, fantastic director. I don't know why she was in like director jail or something for a little while.
When I was thinking about endings today, I thought about the ending of Making Mr. Right.
Oh yeah.
Is that the Ellen DeGeneres?
No, that's Mr. Wrong.
My bad.
This is the one with Ann Magnuson and John Malkovich.
Like, why would you be thinking of the end
about Ann Magnuson too, working with Ann Magnuson, the fantastic performance artist.
Has a small role in Desperately Seeking Susan, but then got to be the lead in Making Mr. Right.
Yeah, yeah. Revisit Susan Seidelman's work. If you do have the Criterion Channel, it is streaming on that. So Smithereens.
Full circle.
Also, Richard Hell is in it. And he's like, he plays such a good slime ball. Such a good slime
like
ball.
It.
New York slime ball. Okay, so next week we'll be joined by the head writer of the new show, The New Negroes, who it's starring some of our friend of the pods, you know, Baron Vaughn. And then also Open Mike Eagle, Max Fun. He's, you know, it's their show. It's going to be great. So Kevin Avery's going to be on with us. And we have a review to read. Does anyone want to read this review?
Oh, me, I do.
You have to read the all caps like it's all caps
of course.
Part, though.
Quick reminder, everybody, leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. We will read it here on the show. Just like Not Myself Today, 1996, who writes, Cinephiles old and new rejoice. Here's your new favorite group of people. The banter is the stuff of dreams. The opinions are sharp and well-founded, and the discussions are nothing short of wonderful. Ricky is like my old friend. Alonzo is like the older brother I want to impress. April is quick-witted and so, so fun to listen to. And my personal favorite, Drea the Dope Rhyme Slayer, is the funniest person I've ever heard. Keep doing what y'all do. You make my week every time you post.
I'm honestly blushing.
She is. I mean, she's like very white, so we can tell.
I was going to say, she's always on the border, but.
It's right there, yeah.
Okay. Thank you, guys. Hi.
Thanks.
I love to see you, Alonzo and Drea.
Always a pleasure.
Thanks everyone for listening too. God, I hope that we made it through like the whole one and you stayed with us the whole time. If you've got a comment or suggestion about this week's show, keep it to yourself. No!
Stop it!
Tweet at us at WhoShotYaPod or find us on our Facebook group. That's facebook.com/groups/WhoShotYaPodcast. Or you can also send us an email at whoshotya@maximumfun.org. And again, that Who Shot line, very important. WSY 803-1664. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of MaximumFun.org. That's what's up.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.